Good afternoon and welcome to Unfiltered Finance. I'm your host, Ron Geffner. I started my career at the SEC in the early 90s. I spent the last 30 plus years on the inside of Wall Street. And the purpose of the podcast is to open the kimono and give you insight because it's about time you learn how the sausage was made. With me today is Matt Polyak, who is a client of the firm. Matt, welcome to Unfiltered Finance.
Thanks so much, Ron. I really appreciate you having me. I'm Matt Polyak. I'm the founder of Hummingbird Capital, which is a long-short energy-focused hedge fund based out of Chicago. So appreciate you having me on.
Come on. It's a pleasure. Like I said earlier, as we were speaking, I'm connected with you on social media as well. So how do I not continue the dialogue with you on the podcast? So one of the things I find that people always ask me about that are not in the industry, how did you get into the space?
My passion for investing, I was very fortunate to fall in love with stock trading as quickly as I did, because it gave me a sense of purpose and direction that was magnetic. I started trading stocks with bar mitzvah money. I was looking into Nestle at the time and Apple and trying to figure out good places to put some bar mitzvah money to work. And then in college, I was actually pre-med, but I shifted from medicinal chemistry to an econ major because the summer of my freshman year, I had about $600 saved up that I turned into 15 grand. And really a lot of it was just dumb luck where I had no idea what I was doing with my first few investments and doubled my money in 2 weeks. And for a college kid to make 600 bucks in 2 weeks after telemarketing all summer was quite the juxtaposition of reality. And so I just went down a rabbit hole of trying to educate myself as much as possible about how to trade stocks. And I was trading penny stocks. I was doing research on 3D printing at the time was kind of the cool thing. Just trying to figure it out and reading Investor's Business Daily and anything that I could get my hands on or speak to anyone who I could speak to who was willing to talk to me. I was literally just a sponge. And so to the extent that I fell in love with the industry, I knew that that's what I wanted to pursue as a career. And I was very, very fortunate to have that sense of direction so clearly at a relatively young age, as a college kid. Everything just became pretty clear to me. And I loved the meritocracy of it. I loved the substantive nerding out and doing deep research and then putting those ideas to work.
Was there anybody in your, like, at that stage of your career that was really helpful or that might have added to your motivation?
Absolutely.
And the reason I'm asking that is I'm assuming there's a young Matt listening to this podcast or Matilda, right? And maybe help open their creative thoughts by sharing that part of your life story.
You know, I think I could spend this whole podcast talking about how fortunate I was to have certain individuals helping me along the way. But we won't do that. What I will say is I would encourage any young man or woman who is interested in anything that they're doing to pursue whatever it is that they're most passionate about. I believe that is going to be the best North Star in terms of career success, finance, happiness, personal finances, happiness, whatever it is. If you really love what you do, I truly believe that that no work is really just that. So that helps with motivation. And then along the way, I was calling people in college, like I said, just trying to be a sponge, calling people who were trading in their day trading in their personal accounts and trying to figure things out. I was talking to portfolio managers who had been doctors, who became portfolio managers at large hedge funds. So those were great perspectives to get. I would literally just pick up the phone and call anyone who was willing to talk to me. And that was super valuable. But as my career sort of progressed past college, and the way that I got my initial internship at Bally Asney Asset Management out of college, I was very fortunate to get connected with Dimitri Bally Asney as a college student. And I knew him as a very successful individual, but I didn't really appreciate to the extent that he had built such an amazing business when I had called him. And when I had called him and spoke to him, I was just inquiring and saying, "Hey, I like trading stocks. Can I pick your brain?" He was kind enough to answer the phone while boarding a plane and talk to me. Just a college kid. And that was so awesome to me. You know, there was, so, you know, down the line, I had four internships and, or four interviews for the internship and became an intern and met so many great people who helped me along the career, along my career. Dan Orr, Christian Zahn, Saul Garber, Doug Garber, just Taylor O'Malley. I mean, I can talk to so many people who I've met and was fortunate enough to learn from or work with. And every one of those experiences in life were invaluable. So I don't believe in the concept of a self-made person. Everyone is made by, you know, the community around them and those that they surround themselves with. And I think that's so important to have a good infrastructure and support system around you in order to be successful.
So why do you think they spoke to you specifically? Because I'm assuming they probably received calls from many other people. And I know I get random calls from people that are in law school or email, and some resonate with me, some catch me at the right time, some don't. So you must think that there must be some common thread as to why all these people took their call, took your call and took the time, however long it was or however short it was, to get to know you and to impart things on you.
I think that I generally believe in the goodness of people, and people want to help if you ask and you put yourself out there. I think, you know, a lot of it was also frankly just luck on my end, and to the extent that they saw a young, hungry, passionate individual. You know, I try and do that today when people are emailing me or reaching out to me with as much, you know, passion or vigor as possible. The people who go that extra step to ask and genuinely are curious, I think that kind of potential is, it's kind of a sin to leave it untapped. So, just about helping, I think, helping other people.
No, look, I totally agree with you. It's more about, from my perspective, making the world a better place. And how do you make the world a better place? You help those around you. And it's an honor to be in that position as opposed to an obligation. So I see the world the same way as you do in that regard. So then what led you, where were you, what led you to launching your funds?
So I got to spend the first 10 decade of my career at Bally Asney, Millennium, Verition, and Intrinsic Edge Capital Management. So I got to work at these great institutions and these great funds, working with different portfolio managers and seeing different aspects of the finance industry at the highest level. And my process evolved every one of the stops along the way. So learning as much as I possibly could, taking that same mentality, whether I was a intern or senior analyst or portfolio manager. And I think that's kind of also at the heart of any good investment process is the desire to consistently improve. I think my personal ambition and aspiration was always to take the entrepreneurial route and sort of be the master of my own destiny to the extent that I could. And so, Hummingbird Capital was sort of launched as a labor of love of what I do and what I hope to grow my business into is still ahead of us. But the process evolved every step of the way, and was very fortunate to spend that time learning from these great institutions.
Do you think, going back to the entrepreneurial spirit, do you think it's something you were always wired to be that way? Or was there a life experience that sort of put you on that path? Because I can
Yes.
point to a few things in my own biography that lend itself to that question.
I think the answer is yes to both parts of the question.
Yeah.
And to give some examples, I think I have a tendency as an individual to like to be in control of what I'm doing, and am frustrated by bureaucracy. Especially when I was younger, I think I tended to see the finish line and want to rush to get there because I already saw where the ball was going. And as I've gotten older, it's certainly given me the perspective of slowing down and enjoying the journey a little bit more. Taking a stoic path, I think, is one that is sometimes lost on gratitude. And so, to the extent that you can enjoy the journey more, great. But in terms of the context of owning my own business and how I put that into work every day at Hummingbird Capital, the portfolio, the process, every part of what I do only gets better by the small little moments. And I really mean that. I think a good process is iterative and fundamental, and there's a lot of hard work going on to make it scalable and repeatable. But the aspect of spending 15 minutes on a walk with my wife outside just to let my brain sort of cool off is something that I might not have applied at one of these shops where it's just go, go, go. And the freedom to sort of adapt to what lives or dies. This is a business where you live or die by the sword, quite literally, is improved upon by that life experience. So all of that is to say, I've always had, I've always been rebellious, and I've always had issues with authority as a teenager and what have you. But really kind of letting my business get the nurturing that it needs and evolve in the way that that is empirically best, is something that I'm comfortable applying my own sort of brushstrokes to, rather than in the context of a firm.
And what was the most challenging or caused the greatest fear? It could be either of those in connection with the launch of your fund, your hedge funds.
What was my greatest fear about launching the
Either
fund?
the greatest fear, the toughest challenge tied to that.
Well, every aspect of it was tough, to be honest. It was very tough. It's daunting. I mean, again, as a young man with a young family, there's a lot on the line. It's a big risk. But obviously the pursuit of that dream was inherent to what I always wanted to do and what I wanted to do at that time. So it was scary. But frankly, again, it just comes back to the support structure of especially my wife, my friends. Dan, I can think of Dan Orr in particular, like supporting me. He was my first boss out of school, and just texting with him every day to ask for advice or whatever the example was. that helped me kind of keep going and that's how I'm 4 years into it today.
So, why don't you share with the audience or the listeners, spend a little bit of time talking about your investment strategy or thesis, not anything specific to your portfolio, and where you think the energy sector, since that's the focus, is going, might be going, and whether it's a function of the implementation of AI and new developments, or the closing of the Straits of Hormuz.
Yeah, a lot to talk about there. I'd say so. Hummingbird Capital is a market neutral strategy. The goal here is to make money regardless of whether or not oil is up or down, or solar is going up or down, or if the market is left or right. The goal is consistent uncorrelated alpha. It's a fundamental equity focused strategy, consisting of a portfolio of about 50 to 80 names, where the goal is, from a risk perspective, to neutralize factor exposures and market exposures and let underlying alpha drive returns. So I cover the broader energy ecosphere,
Okay.
and in the context of what's happening with the Strait of Hormuz or AI or just energy on its own, outside of those two massive factors, the opportunity set in my coverage universe is the best that I've ever seen it. And I think we have a pretty fun, 5 year stretch ahead of us at least. And I can get into that more specifically, but
Yeah, no, I'd love to hear that.
yeah.
First, why don't you explain to, just in case a listener doesn't understand what fundamental analysis is relative to technical analysis, and then alpha as well.
The concept of alpha is the returns that you can explain that are unattributed to moves in the market, moves in different factors like momentum or growth or value. It's sort of the isolated return stream that is coming from being correct or incorrect to the best of its ability. So it's inherently uncorrelated by definition. And what fundamental work is taking a deep understanding of every single one of these subsectors that I cover, being able to know supply demand dynamics inside and out of what drives pricing and volume, operational leverage across every name that I cover, and to be up to speed on the newest technologies or changing technologies or different techniques and services that are being applied across the space. So pairing that with a deep understanding of financial leverage of the individual securities in my coverage universe. So what that means is also understanding balance sheet analysis and cash flows of these companies, and how these companies allocate cash flows, and ultimately deciding if that's good or bad. And then there's other parts that I believe that are inherent to a fundamental process, which are being able to quantify qualitative factors, like is a management team good or not? How do you quantify that to the extent that you can fundamentally? I think some of it is obviously more art than science, but it matters to how a security is priced. And so that comes into the process as well. But taking a deep fundamental, not just top down and knowing, how much oil is coming out of the Strait of Hormuz, but having a bottoms up, okay, hey, this company is a pressure pumper, this company is a exploration and production company, and they have better inventory than this other company that's 5 miles away. Those small differences make huge differences in context of the return on investment. So I believe good returns are the output of a good process. And so I marry all of that modeling and subsector intimate knowledge with, okay, how do I get paid? How do I develop a catalyst path? How do I sort of tell the future to my best of the to the best of my ability by putting the mosaic to get pieces together? And so there's regular touch points with C-suite management teams across my coverage universe where we're discussing, hey, if the Strait of Hormuz is closed for another 3 months, how can that impact your business? How can that impact your supply chain? Where, you know, if you're doing business in the Middle East, do you have enough supply on the ground to respond to activity demands while you can't actually bring, you know, ship supplies on shore? And then we'll discuss, you know, trucking or what goes on around it. So then trying to understand like where the pain points are and being able to sort of chart that out with accuracy and understanding where I'm differentiated versus consensus, especially, drives the underlying return stream here. And that's how I'm able to stay so consistent in being able to put up positive returns. You know, the goal is 9 or 10 months out of the year. So by keeping idea generation so high, by having all these touch points and by being right over 50% of the time, Ken Griffin always said, you know, his best portfolio managers have low 50s hit rates. And to the extent that it's better than that, then that's kind of where the edge is expressed.
Makes sense. So you were going to share about the energy sector in the next 5 years in particular.
Well, I mean, the market has sort of left energy for dead. A lot of the best energy investors out there have a lot of, there's not many of us left. The first 7 years of my career were the longest energy bear market ever. And today, energy is still only low 3% of the S&P 500, but it's generating double digit teens percent of the free cash flow of the market. And then in an environment where some of these hyperscalers are going free cash flow negative, or you know, you're seeing some of these hyperscalers spend more and more capital. Who's going to benefit? The companies that capital is getting spent on. So 25% of every capital dollar that is being invested in AI is going towards energy or infrastructure for power. The biggest bottleneck for these data centers is power. And that means energy. I use them synonymously. And so in the evolution of the data center dynamic, you have this structural secular tailwind where market free cash flow is compressing. You have secular investment and demand growth across the energy space for at least the next 20 years, or pick an arbitrary number, until, you know, however long you think it takes for AI to actually saturate in its growth. And people just sort of changed their opinion on energy, where the question 10 years ago was, are we going to use oil in 10 years? Now the question today is, how much more oil or gas or solar power or hydrogen or nuclear power or whatever it is that we need to make our economy grow and make our lives better? How much of that are we going to need? So I think that dynamic change has also removed some of the terminal value questions that plagued energy. So all of this is to say energy is 3% of the benchmark, and it's done well year to date on the back of the Strait of Hormuz being closed and oil prices being higher. But I still think that we are underweight energy because these companies are just going to make so much money.
When you say we, are you who are you referencing with regard to we?
We as a market, like the market, is underweight energy. So I can't, I'm as underweight energy as I am over, like half my book is long and half my book is short. So, but I do think that your average generalist should be, there's a lot of money to be made here. And there's a lot of cool new technologies and cool new ways of doing things that are evolving. And in the meantime, there's quite a lot of free cash flow to go around for everybody. Especially when kind of the legacy names that you've owned for the past 35 years are now going free cash flow negative. And that piece of the free cash flow pie in terms of the S&P 500, we can go from, 12% of free cash flow in the S&P 500 to over 20%, depending on how much capital actually gets spent. So there's a regime change going on right now.
So, is there anything on the horizon that you think might, that concerns you that might kill or harm the thesis of the next several years being a good place to allocate money and energy?
There's always plenty of concerns. I think to the extent that irrational things happen more frequently as capital comes into the space, where there's a name that goes viral on whatever social media platform. I don't find that to be a fundamental driver of an equity, but that tends to be an opportunity for a strategy like mine to capitalize on. But on the back end of where my concerns lie, I would just say, do we get data centers in space with, can we make couple hundred foot radiators more efficient on the back of some of these satellites? And are though can we make the efficiency frontier on some of the solar panels good enough in space to power that, or to the extent that something like we saw with DeepSeek last year, where inference models versus kind of just efficiency is kind of misunderstood, where do these data centers wind up needing 1/1 millionth of the power that they need today? And what I've seen, at least up until this point, is there's you could discuss the whole Jevons paradox of the more efficient that they get, the more demand there will actually be. But and the more power will actually be consumed. But I think that a lot of the efficiency gains are more marginal ahead. But it's definitely an interesting time, and I think even if that happens, then you're still 10, 15% of the market's free cash flow and only 3% of the market.
Do you see space exploration as intersecting with energy? Because there's more and more investment going into space opportunity. And I'm not just talking about SpaceX.
I think the only way that I can think of the intersection right now is putting solar panels onto satellites, and then figuring out how to actually make these data centers in space more efficient. And I sort of underappreciated it until I actually learned more about it, where it's like, oh, data centers in space, this is definitely a bubble. But the more I learned about it, I mean, Elon Musk has a great team of engineers behind him, and I'm sure there will be data centers in space.
So to that end, educate us. What are the one or two things you learned about data centers in space that you think the audience might find of interest?
I think my main takeaway there was like, okay, you can actually like string. I didn't even understand, like, I'm not a space guy, right? So I didn't even understand, like, if a data center is in space, how is that data going to get back to Earth? Like, I don't understand it. But yeah, obviously the same way that satellites work now with SpaceX, like, you can kind of connect all these satellites together with lasers, and that data comes back down. And then on the back of the satellite, I think like the dealing with space and ambient sort of temperatures is the issue. So you have to like strap a couple hundred foot radiator onto the back of these satellites, and to the extent that you can make that more efficient and less bulky, then you ha is my best understanding of it is then you have a better data center in space. But maybe I'm just old-fashioned and believe we should build data centers on the ground. But yeah, a lot of that is something I'm actually just doing more work on at the moment, and it's just interesting, but it's something to think about.
So, taking the gear a little bit more macro, what are your thoughts on the economy as a whole? And do you have any concerns about its effect on your strategy or any other aspect
I
of
think
the
there's
business?
always concerns about the economy as it pertains to the strategy. I think structuring the portfolio in a way that is neutral is obviously a good start, but to be macro aware is important, especially in the context of running an energy strategy. I'd say concerns on inflation being stickier are probably going to alleviate to the extent that crude oil stays in the 80s as it is today, versus 200 that was feared. And so, to the extent that that problem resolves itself, I think people forget that oil is in everything, our clothes, tires, trucking, freight, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you name it, it's got oil in it. So the downstream effects of having a pretty comfortable oil price in the 80s is still relatively elevated. But if you inflation adjust versus even 5 years ago, it's maybe more like low 70s, high 60s. So that's not terrible. And so I think there's been this myopic view on inflation, and food prices have also kind of went higher. But to the extent that your average consumer can manage their spending and dealing with sort of any sort of credit exposure, and to the extent that you actually get back onto a rate cut path, I think the economy can see meaningful GDP growth. On the back of AI, I'm not in the camp of, all the jobs that'll be destroyed at the moment. I think it's something that's
Because of
going to,
AI, you mean, right?
yeah, because of AI.
Yeah.
But it's possible but the way I'm using AI is just allows me to be significantly more efficient at work. And I believe that you'll see initially, at least, that efficiency show up in investment, consumption, and then you only have government spending and net exports on the back end of it to figure out whatever GDP is. But yeah.
Well, coming back full circle to you as a person, if you had the opportunity to speak to your younger self, what age would that be, and what would you say to that person? Or is there nothing that you could provide insight to younger Matt that isn't worth the time travel?
Yeah, I'm trying to talk to younger Matt on a daily basis. So
We all are trying to
the
speak to that, but.
Matt yesterday. I mean, even the Matt, even who I was yesterday, just always trying to get better. But I think my philosophy, growing up was, do the right, do what is right and necessary, and let what will happen happen. And I think that stoicism held me back because, the realities of the world is are not always so benevolent, unfortunately. And to the extent that I internalized disappointment or things that or ignored things that didn't move my life forward in a positive way or have a positive impact on those around me, I think each one of those experiences were obviously learning experiences. But I'm trying to apply much more of a philosophy of also being just more gratitude. Like, don't internalize the things going on around you. Don't just keep your head down and kind of bulldog through. Be grateful and find happiness in the fact that it's just a nice day outside, or that your daughter's laughing in the other room, or whatever it might be. I think happiness is just a perspective, and not an end goal. So I think that is a very valuable lesson, and it makes me a better father, a better husband, a better portfolio manager, a better business owner, and allows me to sort of stay in this flow state of investing, because investing is really stressful. And so to have the infrastructure around you of people who love you and support you is invaluable. And to the extent that you don't have that infrastructure around you, I would encourage you to spend all your time trying to build that infrastructure around you, because, and I speak from experience, when you don't have that infrastructure around you, it's just it makes it that much harder to appreciate all the wonderful things in life. And so, that's kind of the personal perspective on life at large.
Those are good points. I periodically, and it's not every decade, it's more frequent, I'm going through the same realizations that I am responsible for my own sense of happiness, and that for the most part, in almost any circumstance, I can find happiness. I just need to change my perspective.
Totally.
So, but I feel like you're ahead of the game on that one. You found that mindset at a younger age than I did.
Well, I'm grateful for that at the moment, and it's I think it's always a fight, right? It's always a
Yeah,
battle to stay
it's
positive.
always a struggle, but I hear what you're
I
saying.
think.
So, well, is there any other subject you'd want to address that I haven't asked you?
No, I would say, those were great. I think this was a great great quick conversation. I think anything else that you wanted to discuss or go over?
Yeah. So here's a good, interesting closing questions. What outside of generating amazing returns, spending time with your daughter, celebrating the arrival of your new daughter, any other things on the on Matt's list of things to accomplish?
I think in terms of it's I appreciate that opportunity. It's not so much as of what am I setting out to accomplish? It's how do I give back more? Or thinking, my wife and I recently joined the board of the United States Holocaust Memorial and their next generation program. So thinking of ways to give back, or thinking of ways to participate more in the community and address philanthropic efforts that are near and dear to me. That's kind of front of mind at the moment, to participate more in the JUF or St. Jude's, or other things that are near and dear to me, and that I'm trying to spend more time on to accomplish. But I think in terms of what to accomplish, the things are pretty simple. Spend as much time with my family as I possibly can, spend as much time on growing my business that I possibly can. I think the return stream is really special here, and I think what I'm doing is really special, and I think it's a scalable, repeatable strategy that I'm looking forward to growing. and taking advantage of this wonderful opportunity set that the market has given. And outside of that, just spending as much time with friends and family as possible. It's pretty similar. It's simple. And I think to the extent that I can continue to take care of my mind, body, and soul every day is just kind of a personal matter.
Those are all really good. That's a really amazing perspective and good words to live by. So I'd like to thank our guest, Matt. And I'd like to thank the viewers for listening and look forward to how tune in for next time we our next episode.
I really appreciate you having me on, Ron. Thank you so much. Enjoy the conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.